as I hoped he was. I was experiencing, he said, a series of tiny, nearly imperceptible strokes. The process will be slow, but my brain, my mind, is closing down. The little failures of memory that dog us all beyond a certain point will become more noticeable, more debilitating until the time will come when I won't notice them because I will have lost the ability to comprehend anything at all. The days of the week, the events of the morning, or even 10 minutes ago will be beyond my reach. My phone number, my address, my name, and what I did with my life will be gone. In 2, 3, or 4 years' time, I will not recognise my remaining oldest friends, and when I wake in the morning, I will not recognise that I am in my own room. And soon I won't be, because I will need continuous care. I have vascular dementia, the doctor told me, and there was some comfort to be had. There's the slowness of the undoing, which he must have mentioned a dozen times. Also, it's not as bad as Alzheimer's, with its mood swings and aggression. If I'm lucky, it might turn out to be somewhat benign. I might not be unhappy, just a dim old biddy in a chair, knowing nothing, expecting nothing. I had asked him to be frank, so I could not complain. Now he was hurrying me out. There were 12 people in his waiting room wanting their turn. In summary, as he helped me into my coat, he gave me the route map. Loss of memory, short and long term, the disappearance of single words, simple nouns, might be the first to go, then language itself, along with balance, and soon after all motor control, and finally the autonomous nervous system. Bon voyage. I wasn't distressed, not at first. On the contrary, I was elated and urgently wanted to tell my closest friends. I spent an hour on the phone breaking my news. Perhaps I was already losing my grip. It seemed so momentous. All afternoon I pottered about in my study with my housekeeping chores, and by the time I finished there were 6 new box files on the shelves. Stella and John came over in the evening and we ordered in some Chinese food. Between them, they drank 2 bottles of Morgan. I drank green tea. My charming friends were devastated by my description of my future. They're both in their 60s, old enough to start fooling themselves that 77 is still young. Today, in the taxi, as I crossed London at walking pace in the freezing rain, I thought of little else. I'm going mad, I told myself. Let me not be mad. But I couldn't really believe it. Perhaps I was nothing more than a victim of modern diagnostics. In another century, it would have been said of me that I was old and therefore losing my mind. What else would I expect? I'm only dying, then. I'm fading into unknowing. My taxi was cutting through the back streets of Bloomsbury, past the house where my father lived after his second marriage, and past the basement flat where I lived and worked all through the '50s. Beyond a certain age, a journey across the city becomes uncomfortably reflective. The addresses of the dead pile up. We crossed the square where Leon heroically nursed his wife, and then raised his boisterous children with a devotion that amazed us all. One day I too will prompt a moment's reflection in the passenger of a passing cab. It's a popular shortcut, the inner circle of Regent's Park. We crossed the river at Waterloo Bridge. I sat forward on the edge of my seat to take in my favourite view of the city, and as I turned my neck downstream to St Paul's, upstream to Big Ben, the full panoply of tourist London in between, I felt myself to be physically well and mentally intact, give or take the headaches and a little tiredness. However withered, I still feel myself to be exactly the same person I've always been. Hard to explain that to the young. We may look truly reptilian, but we're not a separate tribe. In the next year or two, however, I will be losing my claim to this familiar protestation. The seriously ill, the deranged, are another race, an inferior race. I won't let anyone persuade me otherwise. My cabbie was cursing. Over the river, roadworks were forcing us on a detour toward the old county hall. As we swung off the roundabout, there toward Lambeth, I had a glimpse of St. Thomas's Hospital. It took a clobbering in the Blitz. I wasn't there, thank God. And the replacement buildings and the tower block are a national disgrace. I worked in three hospitals in the duration, Alderhay and the Royal East Sussex, as well as St. Thomas's, and I merged them in my description to concentrate all my experiences into one place. A convenient distortion, and the least of my offences against veracity. It was raining less heavily as the driver made a neat U-turn in the middle of the road to bring us outside the main gates of the museum. With the business of gathering up my bag, finding a £20 note and unfolding my umbrella, I did not notice the car parked immediately in front until my cab pulled away. It was a black Rolls. For a moment I thought it was unattended. In fact, the chauffeur was a diminutive fellow, almost lost behind the front wheel. I'm not sure that what I'm about to describe really rates as a startling coincidence. I occasionally think of the marshals whenever I see a parked Rolls without a driver. It's become a habit over the years. They often pass through my mind, usually without generating any particular feeling. I've grown used to the idea of them. They still appear in the newspapers occasionally, in connection with their foundation and all its good work for medical research, or the collection they've donated to the Tate, or their generous funding of agricultural projects in sub-Saharan Africa. And her parties and their vigorous libel actions against national newspapers. It was not remarkable that Lord and Lady Marshall passed through my thoughts as I approached those massive twin guns in front of the museum, but it was a shock to see them coming down the steps toward me. A posse of officials, I recognised the museum's director, and a single photographer made up a farewell party. Two young men held umbrellas over the marshals' heads as they descended the steps by the columns. I held back, slowing my pace rather than stopping and drawing attention to myself. There was a round of handshakes and a chorus of genial laughter at something Lord Marshall said. He leaned on a walking stick, the lacquered cane that I think has become something of a trademark. He and his wife and the director posed for the camera, then the marshals came away, accompanied by the suited young men with the umbrellas. The museum officials remained on the steps. My concern was to see which way the marshals would go so that I could avoid a head-on encounter. They chose to pass the guns on their left, so I did the same. Concealed partly by the raised barrels and their concrete emplacements, partly by my tilted umbrella, I kept hidden, but still managed a good look. They went by in silence. He was familiar from his photographs. Despite the liver spots and the purplish swags under his eyes, he at last appeared the cruelly handsome plutocrat, though somewhat reduced. Age had shrunk his face and delivered the look he had always fallen short of by a fraction. It was his jaw that had scaled itself down. Bone loss had been kind. He was a little dodgery and flat-footed, but he walked reasonably well for a man of 88. One becomes a judge of these things. But his hand was firmly on her arm, and the stick was not just for show. It has often been remarked upon how much good he did in the world. Perhaps he spent a lifetime making amends. Or perhaps he just swept onward without a thought to live the life that was always his. As for Lola, my high-living, chain-smoking cousin, here she was, still as lean and fit as a racing dog, and still faithful. Who would have dreamed it? This, as they used to say, was the side on which her bread was buttered. That may sound sour, but it went through my mind as I glanced across at her. She wore a sable coat and a scarlet wide-brimmed fedora. Bold rather than vulgar. Near on 80 years old and still wearing high heels. They clicked on the pavement with the sound of a younger woman's stride. There was no sign of a cigarette. In fact, there was an air of the health farm about her, and an indoor tan. She was taller than her husband now, and there was no doubting her vigour. But there was also something comic about her. Or was I clutching at straws? She was heavy on the makeup, quite garish around the mouth, and liberal with the smoothing cream and powder. I've always been a Puritan in this, so I count myself an unreliable witness. I thought there was a touch of the stage villain here, the gaunt figure, the black coat, the lurid lips. A cigarette holder, a lapdog tucked under one arm, and she could have been Cruella de Vil. We passed by each other in a matter of seconds. I went on up the steps, then stopped under the pediment, out of the rain, to watch the group make its way to the car. He was helped in first, and I saw then how frail he was. He couldn't bend at the waist, nor could he take his own weight on one foot. They had to lift him into his seat. The far door was held open for Lady Lola, who folded herself in with a terrible agility. I watched the rolls pull away into the traffic, then I went in. Seeing them laid something heavy on my heart, and I was trying not to think about it or feel it now. I already had enough to deal with today. But Lola's health was on my mind as I gave my bag in at the cloakroom and exchanged cheery good mornings with the porters. The rule here is that one must be escorted up to the reading room in a lift, whose cramped space makes small talk compulsory as far as I'm concerned. As I made it, shocking weather, but improvements were due by the weekend, I couldn't resist thinking about my encounter outside in the fundamental terms of health. I might outlive Paul Marshall, but Lola would certainly outlive me. The consequences of this are clear. The issue has been with us for years. As my editor put it once, publication equals litigation. But I could hardly face that now. There was already enough that I didn't want to be thinking about. I had come here to be busy. I spent a while chatting with the keeper of documents. I handed over the bundle of letters Mr. Nettle wrote me about Dunkirk, most gratefully received. They'll be stored with all the others I've given. The keeper had found me an obliging old colonel of the Buffs, something of an amateur historian himself, who had read the relevant pages of my typescript and faxed through his suggestions. His notes were handed to me now, irascible, helpful. I was completely absorbed by them, thank God. "Absolutely no," underlined twice. "Soldier, serving with the British Army, would say on the double. Only an American would give such an order. The correct term is at the double." I love these little things, this pointillist approach to verisimilitude, the correction of detail that cumulatively gives such satisfaction. "No one would ever think of saying 25-pound guns. The term was either 25-pounders or 25-pounder guns. Your usage would sound distinctly bizarre, even to a man who was not with the Royal Artillery." Like policemen in a search team, we go on hands and knees and crawl our way toward the truth. "You have your RAF chappie wearing a beret." "I really don't think so. Outside the tank corps, even the army didn't have them in 1940. I think you'd better give the man a forage cap." Finally, the colonel, who began his letter by addressing me as Miss Tallis, allowed some impatience with my sex to show through. What was our kind doing anyway, meddling in these affairs? "Madam," underlined three times, "a Stuka does not carry a single 1,000-ton bomb. Are you aware that a Navy frigate hardly weighs that much? I suggest you look into the matter further. Merely a typo. I meant to type pound. I made a note of these corrections and wrote a letter of thanks to the colonel. I paid for some photocopies of documents which I arranged into orderly piles for my own archives. I returned the books I had been using to the front desk and threw away various scraps of paper. The workspace was cleared of all traces of me. As I said my goodbyes to the keeper, I learned that the Marshall Foundation was about to make a grant to the museum. After a round of handshaking with the other librarians and my promise to acknowledge the department's help, a porter was called to see me down. Very kindly, the girl in the cloakroom called a taxi, and one of the younger members of the door staff carried my bag all the way out to the pavement. During the ride back north, I thought about the colonel's letter, or rather, about my own pleasure in these trivial alterations. If I really cared so much about facts, I should have written a different kind of book. But my work was done. There would be no further drafts. These were the thoughts I had as we entered the old tram tunnel under the old witch just before I fell asleep. When I was woken by the driver, the cab was outside my flat in Regent's Park. I filed away the papers I had brought from the library, made a sandwich, then packed an overnight case. I was conscious as I moved about my flat from one familiar room to another that the years of my independence could soon be over. On my desk was a framed photograph of my husband, Thierry, taken in Marseille 2 years before he died. One day I would be asking who he was. I soothed myself by spending time choosing a dress to wear for my birthday dinner. The process was actually rejuvenating. I'm thinner than I was a year ago. As I trailed my fingers along the racks, I forgot about the diagnosis for minutes on end. I decided on a shirt-waisted cashmere dress in dove grey. Everything followed easily then. A white satin scarf held by Emily's cameo brooch. Patent court shoes, low-heeled, of course. A black Davray shawl. I closed the case and was surprised by how light it seemed as I carried it into the hallway. My secretary would be coming in tomorrow before I returned. I left her a note setting out the work I wanted her to do, then I took a book and a cup of tea and sat in an armchair at a window with a view over the park. I've always been good at not thinking about the things that are really troubling me. But I was not able to read. I felt excited. A journey into the country, a dinner in my honour, a renewal of family bonds. And yet I'd had one of those classic conversations with a doctor. I should have been depressed. Was it possible that I was, in the modern term, in denial? Thinking this changed nothing. The car was not due for another half hour, and I was restless. I got out of the chair and went up and down the room a few times. My knees hurt if I sit too long. I was haunted by the thought of Lola, the severity of that gaunt, old painted face, her boldness of stride in the perilous high heels, her vitality ducking into the rolls. Was I competing with her as I trod the carpet between the fireplace and the Chesterfield? I always thought the high life, the cigarettes, would see her off. Even in our 50s, I thought that. But at 80, she has a voracious, knowing look. She was always the superior older girl, one step ahead of me. But in that final important matter, I will be ahead of her, while she'll live on to be 100. I will not be able to publish in my lifetime. The rolls must have turned my head, because the car, when it came, 15 minutes late, was a disappointment. Such things do not usually trouble me. It was a dusty minicab, whose rear seat was covered in nylon fur with a zebra pattern. But the driver, Michael, was a cheerful West Indian lad who took my case and made a fuss of sliding the front passenger seat forward for me. Once it was established that I would not tolerate the thumping music at any volume from the speakers on the ledge behind my head, and he had recovered from a little sulkiness, we got along well and talked about families. He had never known his father, and his mother was a doctor at the Middlesex Hospital. He himself graduated in law from Leicester University, and now he was going to the LSE to write a doctoral thesis on law and poverty in the Third World. As we headed out of London by the dismal Westway, he gave me his condensed version. No property law, therefore no capital, therefore no wealth. "There's a lawyer talking," I said, "drumming up business for yourself." He laughed politely, though he must have thought me profoundly stupid. It is quite impossible these days to assume anything about people's educational level from the way they talk or dress or from their taste in music. Safest to treat everyone you meet as a distinguished intellectual. After 20 minutes, we had spoken enough, and as the car reached a motorway and the engine settled into an unvarying drone, I fell asleep again, and when I woke, we were on a country road, and a painful tightness was around my forehead. I took from my handbag 3 aspirins, which I chewed and swallowed with distaste. Which portion of my mind, of my memory, had I lost to a minuscule stroke while I was asleep? I would never know. It was then, in the back of that tinny little car, that I experienced for the first time something like desperation. Panic would be too strong a word. Claustrophobia was part of it, helpless confinement within a process of decay, and a sensation of shrinking. I tapped Michael's shoulder and asked him to turn on his music. He assumed I was indulging him because we were close to our destination, and he refused. But I insisted, and so the thumping, twangy bass noise resumed, and over it a light baritone, chanting in Caribbean patois to the rhythms of a nursery rhyme or a playground skipping rope jingle. It helped me. It amused me. It sounded so childish, though I had a suspicion that some terrible sentiments were being expressed. I didn't ask for a translation. The music was still playing as we turned into the drive of Tilney's Hotel. More than 25 years had passed since I came this way for Emily's funeral. I noticed first the absence of parkland trees, the giant elms lost to disease, I supposed, and the remaining oaks cleared to make way for a golf course. We were slowing now to let some golfers and their caddies cross. I couldn't help thinking of them as trespassers. The woods that surrounded Grace Turner's old bungalow were still there, and as the drive cleared a last stand of beeches, the main house came into view. There was no need to be nostalgic. It was always an ugly place. But from a distance it had a stark and unprotected look. The ivy, which used to soften the effect of that bright red facade, had been stripped away, perhaps to preserve the brickwork. Soon we were approaching the first bridge, and already I could see that the lake was no longer there. On the bridge, we were suspended above an area of perfect lawn, such as you sometimes see in an old moat. It was not unpleasant in itself, if you did not know what had once been there, the sedge, the ducks, and the giant carp that 2 tramps had roasted and feasted on by the island temple, which had also gone. Where it stood was a wooden bench and a litter basket. The island, which of course was no longer that, was a long mound of smooth grass like an immense ancient barrow where rhododendrons and other shrubbery were growing. There was a gravel path looping round with more benches here and there, and spherical garden lights. I did not have time to try and estimate the spot where I once sat and comforted the young Lady Lola Marshall, for we were already crossing the second bridge, and then slowing to turn into the asphalted car park that ran the length of the house. Michael carried my case into the reception area in the old hall. How odd that they should have taken the trouble to lay needle-cord carpet over those black and white tiles. I suppose that the acoustic was always troublesome, though I never minded it. a Vivaldi season was burbling through concealed speakers. There was a decent rosewood desk with a computer screen and a vase of flowers, and standing guard on each side were two suits of armour. Mounted on the panelling, crossed halberds and a coat of arms. Above them, the portrait that used to be in the dining room, which my grandfather imported to give the family some lineage. I tipped Michael and earnestly wished him luck with property rights and poverty. I was trying to unsay my foolish remark about lawyers. He wished me happy birthday and shook my hand, how feathery and unassertive his grip was, and left. From behind the desk, a grave-faced girl in a business suit gave me my key and told me that the old library had been booked for the exclusive use of our party. The few who had already arrived had gone out for a stroll. The plan was to gather for drinks at 6. A porter would bring my case up. There was a lift for my convenience. No one to greet me then, but I was relieved. I preferred to take it in alone, the interest of so much change, before I was obliged to become the guest of honour. I took the lift to the second floor, went through a set of glass fire doors, and walked along the corridor whose polished boards creaked in a familiar way. It was bizarre to see the bedrooms numbered and locked. Of course, my room number, 7, told me nothing, but I think I'd already guessed where I would be sleeping. At least, when I stopped outside the door, I wasn't surprised. Not my old room, but Auntie Venus's, always considered to have the best view in the house, over the lake, the driveway, the woods, and the hills beyond. Charles, Piero's grandson and the organising spirit, would have reserved it for me. It was a pleasant surprise stepping in. Rooms on either side had been incorporated to make a grand suite. On a low glass table stood a giant spray of hothouse flowers. The huge high bed Auntie Venus had occupied for so long without complaint had gone, and so had the carved trousseau chest and the green silk sofa. They were now the property of the eldest son by Leon's second marriage, and installed in a castle somewhere in the Scottish Highlands. But the new furnishings were fine, and I liked my room. My case arrived. I ordered a pot of tea and hung my dress. I explored my sitting room, which had a writing desk and a good lamp, and was impressed by the vastness of the bathroom, with its potpourri and stacks of towels on a heated rack. It was a relief not to see everything in terms of tasteless decline. It easily becomes a habit of age. I stood at the window to admire the sunlight slanting over the golf course and burnishing the bare trees on the distant hills. I could not quite accept the absence of the lake, but it could be restored one day, perhaps, and the building itself surely embraced more human happiness now as a hotel than it did when I lived here. Charles phoned an hour later, just as I was beginning to think about getting dressed. He suggested that he come to get me at 6:15, after everyone else was gathered, and bring me down so that I could make an entrance. And so it was that I entered that enormous L-shaped room, on his arm in my cashmere finery to the applause, and then the raised glasses of 50 relatives. My immediate impression as I came in was of recognising no one, not a familiar face. I wondered if this was a foretaste of the incomprehension I had been promised. Then slowly people came into focus. One must make allowances for the years and the speed with which babes in arms become boisterous 10-year-olds. There was no mistaking my brother, curled and slumped to one side in his wheelchair, a napkin at his throat to catch the spills of champagne that someone held to his lips. As I leaned over to kiss Leon, he managed a smile and the half of his face still under his control. And nor did I mistake for long Piero, much shrivelled and with a shining pate I wanted to put my hand on, but still twinkly as ever, and very much the pater familias. It's accepted that we never mention his sister. I made a progress round the room, with Charles at my side, prompting me with the names. How delightful to be at the heart of such a good-willed reunion. I reacquainted myself with the children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren of Jackson, who died 15 years ago. In fact, between them, the twins had fairly peopled the room. And Leon had not done so badly either, with his 4 marriages and dedicated fathering. We ranged in age from 3 months to his 89 years, and what a din of voices, from gruff to shrill, as the waiters came round with more champagne and lemonade. The aging children of distant cousins greeted me like long-lost friends. Every second person wanted to tell me something kind about my books. A group of enchanting teenagers told me how they were studying my books at school. I promised to read the typescript novel of someone's absent son. Notes and cards were pressed into my hands. Piled on a table in the corner of the room were presents which I would have to open, several children told me, before, not after, their bedtime. I made my promises. I shook hands, kissed cheeks and lips, admired and tickled babies, and just as I was beginning to think how much I wanted to sit down somewhere, I noticed that chairs were being set out facing one way. Then Charles clapped his hands and, shouting over the noise that barely subsided, announced that before dinner there was to be an entertainment in my honour. Would we all take our seats? I was led to an armchair in the front row. Next to me was old Piero, who was in conversation with a cousin on his left. A fidgety near silence descended on the room. From a corner came the agitated whispers of children, which I thought it tactful to ignore. While we waited, while I had, as it were, some seconds to myself, I looked about me and only now properly absorbed the fact that all the books were gone from the library, and all the shelves, too. That was why the room had seemed so much bigger than I remembered. The only reading matter was the country magazines in racks by the fireplace. At the sound of shushing and the scrape of a chair, there stood before us a boy with a black cloak over his shoulders. He was pale, freckled and ginger-haired, no mistaking a Quincy child. I guessed him to be about 9 or 10 years old. His body was frail, which made his head seem large and gave him an ethereal look. But he looked confident as he gazed around the room, waiting for his audience to settle. Then at last he raised his elfin chin, filled his lungs, and spoke out in a clear, pure treble. I'd been expecting a magic trick, but what I heard had the ring of the supernatural. This is the tale of spontaneous Arabella, who ran off with an extrinsic fellow. It grieved her parents to see their firstborn, Evaness, from her home to go to Eastbourne without permission, to get ill and find indigence until she was down to her last sixpence. Suddenly she was right there before me, that busy, priggish, conceited little girl. And she was not dead either, for when people tittered appreciatively at Evaness, my feeble heart, ridiculous vanity, made a little leap. The boy recited with a thrilling clarity and a jarring touch of what my generation would call Cockney, though I have no idea these days what the significance is of a glottal T. I knew the words were mine, but I barely remembered them, and it was hard to concentrate with so many questions, so much feeling crowding in. Where had they found the copy? And was this unearthly confidence a symptom of a different age? I glanced at my neighbour, Pierrot. He had his handkerchief out and was dabbing at his eyes, and I don't think it was only great-grandfatherly pride. I also suspected that this was all his idea. The prologue rose to its reasonable climax. For that fortuitous girl the sweet day dawned, to wed her gorgeous prince, but be warned, because Arabella almost learned too late, that before we love, we must cogitate. We made a rowdy applause. There was even some vulgar whistling. That dictionary, that Oxford Concise. Where was it now? Northwest Scotland. I wanted it back. The boy made a bow and retreated a couple of yards and was joined by four other children who had come up, unnoticed by me, and were waiting in what would have been the wings. And so the trials of Arabella began, with a leave-taking from the anxious, saddened parents. I recognised the heroine immediately as Leon's great-granddaughter Chloe. What a lovely, solemn girl she is, with her rich, low voice and her mother's Spanish blood. I remember being at her first birthday party, and it seemed only months ago. I watched her fall convincingly into poverty and despair, once abandoned by the wicked count, who was the prologue speaker in his black cloak. In less than 10 minutes it was over. In memory, distorted by a child's sense of time, it had always seemed the length of a Shakespeare play. I had completely forgotten that after the wedding ceremony, Arabella and the medical prince link arms and, speaking in unison, step forward to address to the audience a final couplet. "Here's the beginning of love at the end of our travail. So farewell, kind friends, as into the sunset we sail." Not my best, I thought. But the whole room, except for Leon, Piero and myself, rose for the applause. How practiced these children were, right down to the curtain call. Hand in hand, they stood in line abreast, taking their cue from Chloe, stepped back 2 paces, came forward, bowed again. In the uproar, no one noticed that poor Piero was completely overcome and put his face in his hands. Was he reliving that lonely, terrifying time here after his parents' divorce? They'd so much wanted to be in the play, the twins, for that evening in the library, and here it was at last, 64 years late, and his brother long dead. I was helped out of my comfortable chair and made a little speech of thanks. Competing with a wailing baby at the back of the room, I tried to evoke that hot summer of 1935, when the cousins came down from the north. I turned to the cast and told them that our production would have been no match for theirs. Piero was nodding emphatically. I explained that it was entirely my fault the rehearsals fell apart, because halfway through I had decided to become a novelist. There was indulgent laughter, more applause, then Charles announced that it was dinner. And so the pleasant evening unravelled. The noisy meal, at which I even drank a little wine, the presents, bedtime for the younger children while their bigger brothers and sisters went off to watch television. Then speeches over coffee and much good-natured laughter, and by 10 o'clock I was beginning to think of my splendid room upstairs, not because I was tired, but because I was tired of being in company and the object of so much attention, however kindly. Another 30 minutes passed in good nights and farewells before Charles and his wife Annie escorted me to my room. Now it is 5 in the morning, and I'm still at the writing desk, thinking over my strange 2 days. It's true about the old not needing sleep, at least not in the night. I still have so much to consider, and soon, within the year perhaps, I'll have far less of a mind to do it with. I've been thinking about my last novel, the one that should have been my first. The earliest version, January 1940, the latest, March 1999, and in between 6 different drafts. The second draft, June 1947, the third, who cares to know? My 59-year assignment is over. There was our crime, Lola's, Marshall's, mine. And from the second version onward, I set out to describe it. I've regarded it as my duty to disguise nothing, the names, the places, the exact circumstances. I put it all there as a matter of historical record. But as a matter of legal reality, so various editors have told me over the years, my forensic memoir could never be published while my fellow criminals were alive. You may only libel yourself and the dead. The marshals have been active about the courts since the late 40s, defending their good names with a most expensive ferocity. They could ruin a publishing house with ease from their current accounts. One might almost think they had something to hide. Think, yes, but not write. The obvious suggestions have been made. Displace, transmute, dissemble. Bring down the fogs of the imagination. What are novelists for? Go just so far as is necessary. Set up camp inches beyond the reach, the fingertips of the law. But no one knows these precise distances until a judgment is handed down. To be safe, one would have to be bland and obscure. I know I cannot publish until they are dead, and as of this morning, I accept that will not be until I am. No good just one of them going. Even with Lord Marshall's bone-shrunk mug on the obituary pages at last, my cousin from the north would not tolerate an accusation of criminal conspiracy. There was a crime, but there were also the lovers. Lovers and their happy ends have been on my mind all night long. As into the sunset we sail, an unhappy inversion. It occurs to me that I have not travelled so very far after all since I wrote my little play. Or rather, I've made a huge digression and doubled back to my starting place. It is only in this last version that my lovers end well, standing side by side on a South London pavement as I walk away. All the preceding drafts were pitiless. But now I can no longer think what purpose would be served if, say, I tried to persuade my reader by direct or indirect means that Robbie Turner died of septicemia at Bray Dunes on the 1st of June, 1940, or that Cecilia was killed in September of the same year by the bomb that destroyed Balham Underground Station. That I never saw them in that year. That my walk across London ended at the church on Clapham Common, and that a cowardly Bryony limped back to the hospital, unable to confront her recently bereaved sister. That the letters the lovers wrote are in the archives of the War Museum. How could that constitute an ending? What sense or hope or satisfaction could a reader draw from such an account? Who would want to believe that they never met again, never fulfilled their love? Who would want to believe that, except in the service of the bleakest realism? I couldn't do it to them. I'm too old, too frightened, too much in love with the shred of life I have remaining. I face an incoming tide of forgetting, and then oblivion. I no longer possess the courage of my pessimism. When I am dead, and the marshals are dead, and the novel is finally published, we will only exist as my inventions. Bryony will be as much of a fantasy as the lovers who shared a bed in Balham and enraged their landlady. No one will care what events and which individuals were misrepresented to make a novel. I know there's always a certain kind of reader who will be compelled to ask, but what really happened? The answer is simple. The lovers survive and flourish. As long as there is a single copy, a solitary typescript of my final draft, then my spontaneous, fortuitous sister and her medical prince survive to love. The problem these 59 years has been this. How can a novelist achieve atonement when, with her absolute power of deciding outcomes, she is also God? There is no one, no entity or higher form that she can appeal to, or be reconciled with, or that can forgive her. There is nothing outside her. In her imagination, she has set the limits and the terms. no atonement for God or novelists, even if they are atheists. It was always an impossible task, and that was precisely the point. The attempt was all. I've been standing at the window, feeling waves of tiredness beat the remaining strength from my body. The floor seems to be undulating beneath my feet. I've been watching the first grey light bring into view the park and the bridges over the vanished lake, and the long, narrow driveway down which they drove Robbie away, into the whiteness. I like to think that it isn't weakness or evasion, but a final act of kindness, a stand against oblivion and despair, to let my lovers live and to unite them at the end. I gave them happiness, but I was not so self-serving as to let them forgive me. Not quite. Not yet. If I had the power to conjure them at my birthday celebration, Robbie and Cecilia, still alive, still in love, sitting side by side in the library, smiling at the trials of Arabella. It's not impossible. But now I must sleep.
The end. You've been listening to Atonement by Ian McEwan, narrated by Jill Tanner. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends two more titles by Ian McEwan: Enduring Love, narrated by Stephen Crossley, and The Innocent, narrated by John Franklin Robbins. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone, with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Atonement, Disc 2.
Bryony suspected that behind her older cousin's perfect manners was a destructive intent. Perhaps Lola was relying on the twins to wreck the play innocently and needed only to stand back and observe. These unprovable suspicions, Jackson's detainment in the laundry, Piero's wretched delivery and the morning's colossal heat, were oppressive to Bryony. It bothered her too when she noticed Danny Hardman watching from the doorway. He had to be asked to leave. She could not penetrate Lola's detachment or coax from Piero the common inflections of everyday speech. What a relief, then, suddenly to find herself alone in the nursery. Lola had said she needed to reconsider her hair, and her brother had wandered off down the corridor to the lavatory or beyond. Bryony sat on the floor with her back to one of the tall built-in toy cupboards and fanned her face with the pages of her play. The silence in the house was complete. No voices or footfalls downstairs, no murmurs from the plumbing. In the space between one of the open sash windows, a trapped fly had abandoned its struggle, and outside the liquid birdsong had evaporated in the heat. She pushed her knees out straight before her and let the folds of her white muslin dress and the familiar, endearing pucker of skin about her knees fill her view. She should have changed her dress this morning. She thought how she should take more care of her appearance, like Lola. It was childish not to. But what an effort it was. The silence hissed in her ears, and her vision was faintly distorted. Her hands in her lap appeared unusually large, and at the same time remote, as though viewed across an immense distance. She raised one hand and flexed its fingers, and wondered, as she had sometimes before, how this thing, this machine for gripping, this fleshy spider on the end of her arm, came to be hers, entirely at her command? Or did it have some little life of its own? She bent her finger and straightened it. The mystery was in the instant before it moved, the dividing moment between not moving and moving, when her intention took effect. It was like a wave breaking. If she could only find herself at the crest, she thought, she might find the secret of herself, that part of her that was really in charge. She brought her forefinger closer to her face and stared at it, urging it to move. It remained still because she was pretending, she was not entirely serious, and because willing it to move, or being about to move it, was not the same as actually moving it. And when she did crook it finally, the action seemed to start in the finger itself, not in some part of her mind. When did it know to move? When did she know to move it? There was no catching herself out. It was either or. There was no stitching, no seam, and yet she knew that behind the smooth, continuous fabric was the real self. Was it her soul, which took the decision to cease pretending and gave the final command? These thoughts were as familiar to her and as comforting as the precise configuration of her knees, their matching but competing symmetrical and reversible look. A second thought always followed the first. One mystery bred another. Was everyone else really as alive as she was? For example, did her sister really matter to herself? Was she as valuable to herself as Bryony was? Was being Cecilia just as vivid an affair as being Bryony? Did her sister also have a real self concealed behind a breaking wave? And did she spend time thinking about it, with a finger held up to her face? Did everybody, including her father, Betty, Hardman? If the answer was yes, then the world, the social world, was unbearably complicated, with 2 billion voices, and everyone's thoughts striving in equal importance, and everyone's claim on life as intense, and everyone thinking they were unique, when no one was. One could drown in irrelevance. But if the answer was no, then Bryony was surrounded by machines, intelligent and pleasant enough on the outside, but lacking the bright and private inside feelings she had. This was sinister and lonely, as well as unlikely. For though it offended her sense of order, she knew it was overwhelmingly probable that everyone else had thoughts like hers. She knew this, but only in a rather arid way. She didn't really feel it. The rehearsals also offended her sense of order. The self-contained world she had drawn with clear and perfect lines had been defaced with the scribble of other minds, other needs. And time itself, so easily sectioned on paper into acts and scenes, was even now dribbling uncontrollably away. Perhaps she wouldn't get Jackson back until after lunch. Leon and his friend were arriving in the early evening, or even sooner, and the performance was set for 7 o'clock. And still there had been no proper rehearsal, and the twins could not act or even speak, and Lola had stolen Bryony's rightful role, and nothing could be managed, and it was hot, ludicrously hot. The girl squirmed in her oppression and stood. Dust from along the skirting board had dirtied her hands and the back of her dress. Away in her thoughts, she wiped her palms down her front as she went toward the window. The simplest way to have impressed Leon would have been to write him a story and put it in his hands herself and watch as he read it. The title lettering, the illustrated cover, the pages bound. In that word alone, she felt the attraction of the neat, limited and controllable form she had left behind when she decided to write a play. A story was direct and simple, allowing nothing to come between herself and her reader. No intermediaries with their private ambitions or incompetence. No pressures of time. No limits on resources. In a story, you only had to wish. You only had to write it down, and you would have the world. In a play, You had to make do with what was available. No horses, no village streets, no seaside, no curtain. It seemed so obvious now that it was too late. A story was a form of telepathy. By means of inking symbols onto a page, she was able to send thoughts and feelings from her mind to her readers. It was a magical process, so commonplace that no one stopped to wonder at it. Reading a sentence and understanding it were the same thing, as with the crooking of a finger. Nothing lay between them. There was no gap during which the symbols were unravelled. You saw the word castle, and it was there, seen from some distance, with woods in high summer spread before it, the air bluish and soft with smoke rising from the blacksmith's forge, and a cobbled road twisting away into the green shade. She had arrived at one of the nursery's wide-open windows and must have seen what lay before her some seconds before she registered it. It was a scene that could easily have accommodated, in the distance at least, a medieval castle. Some miles beyond the Talises' land rose the Surrey Hills, and their motionless crowds of thick-crested oaks, their green softened by a milky heat haze. Then nearer, the estate's open parkland, which today had a dry and savage look, roasting like a savannah, where isolated trees threw harsh, stumpy shadows, and the long grass was already stalked by the leonine yellow of high summer. Closer within the boundaries of the balustrade were the rose gardens, and nearer still the Triton Fountain, and standing by the basin's retaining wall was her sister, and right before her was Robbie Turner. There was something rather formal about the way he stood, feet apart, head held back. A proposal of marriage. Bryony would not have been surprised. She herself had written a tale in which a humble woodcutter saved a princess from drowning and ended by marrying her. What was presented here fitted well. Robbie Turner, only son of a humble cleaning lady and of no known father. Robbie, who had been subsidised by Bryony's father through school and university, had wanted to be a landscape gardener, and now wanted to take up medicine, had the boldness of ambition to ask for Cecilia's hand. It made perfect sense. Such leaps across boundaries were the stuff of daily romance. What was less comprehensible, however, was how Robbie imperiously raised his hand now, as though issuing a command which Cecilia dared not disobey. It was extraordinary that she was unable to resist him. At his insistence, she was removing her clothes, and at such speed. She was out of her blouse, now she had let her skirt drop to the ground, and was stepping out of it, while he looked on impatiently, hands on hips. What strange power did he have over her? Blackmail? Threats? Bryony raised two hands to her face and stepped back a little way from the window. She should shut her eyes, she thought, and spare herself the sight of her sister's shame. But that was impossible, because there were further surprises. Cecilia, mercifully still in her underwear, was climbing into the pond, was standing waist-deep in the water, was pinching her nose, and then she was gone. There was only Robbie and the clothes on the gravel, and beyond, the silent park and the distant blue hills. The sequence was illogical. The drowning scene, followed by a rescue, should have preceded the marriage proposal. Such was Bryony's last thought, before she accepted that she did not understand, and that she must simply watch. Unseen from two stories up, with the benefit of unambiguous sunlight, she had privileged access across the years to adult behaviour, to rites and conventions she knew nothing about as yet. Clearly these were the kinds of things that happened. Even as her sister's head broke the surface, thank God, Bryony had her first weak intimation that for her now it could no longer be fairy tale castles and princesses, but the strangeness of the here and now, of what passed between people, the ordinary people that she knew, and what power one could have over the other, and how easy it was to get everything wrong, completely wrong. Cecilia had climbed out of the pond and was fixing her skirt, and with difficulty pulling her blouse on over her wet skin. She turned abruptly and picked up from the deep shade of the fountain's wall a vase of flowers Bryony had not noticed before, and set off with it toward the house.